Thanks for staying on with us. As promised, joining us is the MP for Bangi, YB, Dr. Ong Kian Ming. Kian Ming was talking about an open letter that was sent basically addressing to the US President, which I find quite interesting, trying to rethink about the multilateral relationship that the US should have with ASEAN countries, with other Asian countries. So maybe let's talk a little bit more about this very unique approach of sending an open letter to the President of the US.
Yeah, I think it's been done before when President Obama visited Malaysia when BN was still in government. I think my colleague Tony Pua issued an open letter to him. But I think perhaps then it was maybe more a reminder to ourselves rather than to the President of the US. This time, I think probably it's a bit of both. Firstly, reminder to President Biden that Southeast Asia is an important part of the world for him to engage, Vice President Harris to engage with. And then also for us to remind ourselves that we are also important to the US. We should also make our voices heard louder compared to before.
Yeah, one thing that I find interesting is that the first point that you raised was that the U.S. should not look at the relationship with Southeast Asia as a reactive towards how to manage China. It has to be a little bit more proactive in terms of how to use trade, how to manage multilateral ties between one another. But, you know, coming back from the Trump administration, it is very problematic for the U.S. to really think more about its multilateral ties. There's a lot that's happening at home, anywhere from violence to universal healthcare. How do you see this moving forward?
Actually, I do think that the Biden administration is on the right track. You know, he rejoined the Paris Climate Accords straight after he took office in January, and he recently held a 40-country global climate summit online, albeit. Including countries like China in the discussion. Of course, Malaysia wasn't invited because apparently we don't have any climate issues. But that's another story. You know, Singapore and I think Indonesia were invited from Southeast Asia. So I think that kind of approach is something that's very welcome after the Trump administration. But what I found disappointing, in regards to his address to Congress, to the both houses of Congress, was the fact that he didn't really mentioned Asia much. Japan was totally left out. Korea was only mentioned in regards to North Korea. And, the word Asia actually didn't appear in his text at all, which I found very troubling because, you know, he was the vice president when President Obama talked about the Asia pivot, right? And then his only mention of Asia was actually primarily to do with China. Four mentions of China, one mention of Beijing. Right. And then India was mentioned only once. So I think all these things actually matter because world leaders are actually looking at his speech. And you know, although they are on the right track in terms of wanting to restore multilateral ties, it cannot be, again, premised on wanting to manage and contain China. It has got to be a broader discussion. And I hope that, my letter gets sent to the right people and, along the food chain and then hopefully gets to the White House somehow. Wishful thinking on my part.
Who knows, right? Word travels. Let's talk a little bit more about the infrastructure development that you think the U.S. should focus on, anywhere from the AIIB or the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. We used to talk about that a lot 4 or 5 years ago, but nobody seems to be talking about that now. Asia Development Bank, of course. There seems to be a lot of push from China to invest in these countries in this part of the world, but the U.S.
BRI course, projects, yep.
Yeah, but U.S. is thinking very much inwardly these days. They don't want to focus too much on international affairs. How do you see this moving forward?
I think the U.S. is focusing a lot on its own internal infrastructure capabilities. It wants to build more roads and rails and stuff like that within the U.S. But I think that would be probably a little bit short-sighted in the sense that the U.S. can also be a very important partner to other infrastructure projects in the region. Maybe not in terms of construction companies or let's say high-speed rails, because that one is dominated by China, Japan, Korea. But especially in regards to software, the software components trying to manage, for example, customers in these infrastructure projects that will be used by corporates as well as individuals. These are areas where I think the US really can take a lead, and I think it can actually try to at least not discourage possible cooperation between AIIB, which is a China-led, you know, regional sort of like multilateral investment bank, and then also ADB, that is, you know, sort of like seen as Japan-led, which of course means that the United States also has some, you know, influence there. So, you know, just throwing some ideas out there. If let's say we manage to revive the KL Singapore High Speed Rail again, you know, would this be a project that both these institutions are willing to come in, even World Bank or, you know, other multilateral institutions? I think that would be something that's worth exploring.
There's also that unique element that you were in because of being the Deputy Minister of International Trade and Affairs and Industry, pardon me. You would have had access to some interesting information about how Malaysia should be courting big investors like the US and China. How would you perceive this government's approach in courting such investments, particularly when both of us know that the foreign direct investments into the country has been depleting quite steadily over the past few years? No sense of indications that foreign direct investment is going to see an uptick anytime soon. Are we in a dire place right now?
Yeah, I think this has partly to do with the COVID pandemic, which has stopped a lot of investors from coming to visit Malaysia to explore investment opportunities. And that the pandemic has also stopped some of the construction on existing projects, especially some factories that I know of that were, you know, that were already commissioned and approved in Penang, either in the E&E sector or in other parts of manufacturing. So, you know, don't really want to be too hard on the civil servants, especially from MIDA and MITI. I think they're trying to do their best. But you're right in the sense that the direction is a bit unclear. And of course, not helped by the fact that we seem to be helping one or two companies in this cabotage, you know, undersea cable repair issue. You know, it's basically to protect the interests of one company, one Malaysian company that does not have the capabilities of doing this undersea cable repairs. And then that sends a very bad signal to companies like Google, Facebook, even Amazon, you know, so AWS. So I think that those things actually send a much more negative signal. You know, and it's hard for the civil servants to cover for these kinds of political mistakes.
And it seems that one company you speak of only has one vessel, that and even that one vessel might not up to mark in terms of the repairs. But
exactly,
you know, yeah. Setting aside those kind of signals that you've been sending, right? And of course, the FANG companies have come in very strongly in the first quarter. They just made the announcements this week, actually, and it has superseded all the expectations set by Wall Street, as well as other other analysts around the world. It comes to show that they do have the money when it comes to investments, and losing those kind of money is actually detrimental to us. But I want to think more about sustainability as well, because in your open letter you do describe the kind of opportunities there. Very recently, we've had Maybank Investment coming on my show, talking about the tipping point of EVs, for instance, solar panels, and in a way where it could be as early as 2025, where electric vehicles might supersede ICE vehicles or internal combustion engine vehicles in terms of production. And by 2035, on the road, we're going to see a lot more EVs as compared to internal combustion engine. This is the thing that we want to talk about, the trends of the future, not the problems of today, not just the problems of today. Yeah. When we know that China, for instance, is very aggressive in terms of building sustainable vehicles, sustainable energy, and Malaysia is still, you know, unsure whether or not we are part of the global climate issue or not, at least this government, I want to understand a little bit better about how courting, you know, Western societies like the US or even, I don't know, Western Europe, you think that this would be a good place to start when it comes to trying to hedge our bets on investors in the sustainable business?
I don't think we should hedge our bets. I think we should be inclusive and invite as many players as possible in this EV space. There is actually room for that in the National Automotive Policy that was launched when PH was still in power. One of the things that I really wanted to follow on was the follow-up on the EV infrastructure. Things like your charging stations, your, you know, battery exchanges and things like that. And this one actually requires inter-ministry coordination. It's not something that MITI can do alone. It's not something that MARI can do alone, one of the agencies under MITI. We actually need, for example, the Department of Environment, the Ministry of Environment, the Ministry of Energy, even Consumer Affairs, you know, to come in together to set up the game plan and also the roadmap to roll out all these, you know, EV supportive ecosystem. Right. What I think I'm very saddened by is that we have not seen this kind of interagency initiatives being undertaken. Right. You know, when I was deputy minister, I was already having some initial preliminary discussions with my colleagues from MESTEC. This is under the ministry led by UB in then. I think we really could have pushed for this. But sadly, I don't really see many concrete steps, which means that we're gonna fall further behind in this road for EV, and not just the rollout of EV vehicles, but the kind of supportive infrastructure, which could be a boost to the economy right now, because we need this kind of investment spending during the COVID times, right? And we don't really see that happening.
Yeah, but then again, intergovernmental agency collaboration has always been a problem of any government, actually.
Yeah, but no, we under PH, I think we tried very hard to be able to bridge some of these gaps, and we were successful, you know, because myself, and my Minister Darrell, we worked very well together with MOF, Ministry of Finance under Lim Guan Eng, to get quite a lot of approvals for investment incentives done. And because of that, we managed to attract a lot of good investment, good quality, high quality investments, as what has been said by the current MITI minister to Malaysia when PH was in power.
Okay, let's go back to the letter. We have about 5 or 6 minutes left. I want to touch on the two big problems that you mentioned and the fourth and fifth point in your open letter to the US president is actually quite difficult to be executed because it's not tangible. We're talking about human rights, we're talking about democracy, we're also talking about the soft power projection, I suppose, by the US in this part of the world. Like I said, this is an inward-looking kind of administration for the time being, and understandably so. Do you feel that they might have a greater push or interest to think like they have been thinking for the past 4 or 5 decades ago? Remember, they are executing a once-in-a-generation stimulus package. We're looking at $4 trillion. We're looking at something that might, you know, break or make the U.S. government in the next 100 years. How do you think this will tie up with their intentions of trying to a better relationship in this part of the world?
Yeah, so what I said about human rights was that I think us in this part of the world, even though we have a lot of human rights issues to take care of, including in our own country of Malaysia, including in Myanmar, for example, I think the best thing for the US to do would be to try to work together the subnational level, meaning working together with some of our NGOs, building capacity and whatnot. I know that they'll be tempted to speak out on issues like Hong Kong and even Myanmar, you know, and I think sometimes that voice can be helpful, but it also can be detrimental to the larger impetus that we are trying to do things in a different way. And we saw this happening, in Jakarta when President Jokowi made a very bold move to make an announcement, get the buy-in from all the other ASEAN countries to basically ask for a stop, to the violence in Myanmar. Right? I think that one is a very important step. And that showed that ASEAN can lead on these matters, especially when they are grave consequence. And I think that's the kind of move that we should continue to play. Of course, we also don't want to have the US lecture us too much because, we need to try to get our house in order. But the point that you made about all this spending by the US is something that's very important, because when you spend that kind of money, right, you're not going to be able to have the internal capacity within the US to supply a lot of the goods and services for your infrastructure that you want to build, for the kind of investments that you want to attract. So actually, the US can't help but to attract and to be open to other countries. This includes people from other countries, people from Malaysia, from Southeast Asia going to study in the top universities. And this is what President Biden talked about as well, R&D spending, wanting to attract the best brains, the best talent. And inevitably, some of these brains and talent also come from China. Right. I think this is one area where I think in the initial part, I think President Biden needs to appear tough But I think as time goes on and as the US economy recovers and the COVID issue doesn't become so serious anymore, I do hope that there's room for more win-win situations or win-win solutions as I proposed in my open letter. And I feel optimistic that, more things can be done along the way.
Moving away from your open letter, let's talk a little bit more about how the world is judging ASEAN, is judging Malaysia. There's a lot of failures in on behalf of ASEAN when it comes to improving the livelihood of folks who live here. Myanmar is the latest, yet another example of how ASEAN is a bit too slow in managing that particular question. We've had this big run-up into what ASEAN is going to do last week, actually. All the leaders met face-to-face, their first face-to-face meeting since the pandemic began.
Almost all. The Thailand Prime Minister wasn't there.
Almost all, yeah. And I'm not too sure about Duterte as well. But generally speaking, that's the whole idea, right? ASEAN is not united and concerted in our efforts to try to solve our own problems. This is not new. This is a very long-haul problem. And we all knew how ASEAN was forged with the non-intervention policy and all the other...
consensus.
And limit to it. Yeah. I don't know. I cannot tahan lah, these kind of words, you know, consensus and all this.
But I think there are advantages to the consensus model. You know, it has allowed ASEAN to survive and to some, you know, somebody like Kishore Mahbubani would say that ASEAN is a success story and has thrived. And of course, when we encounter challenges like Myanmar, then the consensus model gets tested. And that's when ASEAN really has to adjust, what its approach will be in the next, you know, for the next 5-10 years, whether this consensus model still can hold or not. And I do believe one of the areas where ASEAN needs to be much more concerted and also united is in the area of FDI, right? And recently I wrote an op-ed piece in an online publication called 9-Line. And in there, I basically argued for ASEAN centrality and leadership in trade and investment, right? So ASEAN is central in the negotiations for RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive and Economic Partnership. Right. We've done a lot of that, a lot of work on that, starting in 2011. And we finally signed the agreement end of last year. Sadly, we couldn't get India on board, but this is something that's really important for ASEAN as well as China, Japan and Korea. Let's push the envelope a bit more. Why not get more ASEAN countries to participate in the CPTPP, for example? Right. Malaysia is in there. We haven't ratified it yet. Brunei is in there. Haven't ratified yet. But Vietnam is there. Singapore is there, you know, the UK wants to join, perhaps after that maybe even Indonesia and Thailand wants to join as well. So right now get more ASEAN members in there, you know, show our strength and solidarity, and then use that as a platform in which we can consolidate and also improve our internal management of investment policies, including Belt and Road investments that are coming into the region.
Final few questions. Some of the businesses in these countries, in ASEAN, might want to think for themselves for the time being. They might not want to look at trade deals and G2G kind of relationships just yet. They might want to be first mover and taking the first advantage to dealings with these kind of governments. Do you feel that we might lose out when there are more aggressive companies across ASEAN? Some companies might just take the bet and just head on to the US or even to China and try to seal the deal for themselves. What does it mean for Malaysia as a country when companies start to move ahead quicker than governments can?
Yeah, no, I would encourage companies who think that they can get a first mover advantage to invest in those countries, right? Sime Darby's investments in China, especially in the auto distributive sector, was not something, as far as I know, that was government-led. They went there themselves, they built the market for themselves, and they're earning a lot of money from that. So that's fine and good. But what I think, let's say, Malaysia needs is basically a more coordinated and coherent strategy to bring our companies to markets like China and India. Because if one company goes to a place like China, they can lose their pants very quickly, right? But let's say they go in together with other companies, with the government paving the way, so to speak, I think Malaysia Inc. can really you know, pave the way for not just big companies like GLCs, but also some of the supporting companies to go along. And Singapore has done this very well in places like China and India. They have very good G2G ties, and then later they bring in some of their strategic companies to invest in, let's say, services, transportation, logistics, and then they will have other smaller companies ride the coattails of the bigger ones. And you know, that's how they expand the market for Singapore companies. I don't see why Malaysia can't do the same. I was trying to do a bit of that when I was deputy minister, but unfortunately, you know, the time was a little bit too short.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kian Ming. That was YB Dr. Ong Kian Ming, the former deputy minister of international trade and industry, and of course, the MP for Bangi. That's it for our show. Catch you in the next one, and continue to stay with us on astroawani.com.